get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas. We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Ever since H.G. Wells' classic novel The Time Machine was published back in 1895, the concept of time travel has proven to be manna from heaven for pencil-chewing scriptwriters. Besides appealing to our longing for the ability to correct mistakes of the past, time travel is the ultimate fish-out-of-water narrative staple that works for comedy, horror, and every genre in between. Cinemaphile and movie blogger Molly Makishin will join me to discuss everything from classics such as Back to the Future and The Terminator to more recent films such as The Butterfly Effect and the newly relaunched TV series Doctor Who. You can read Molly's writing at celluloitering.blogspot.com. Time travel, up next on Under Surveillance. Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance here on WLUW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show we're going to be talking all about the concept of time travel in popular culture. Time travel as it's been expressed through film and television throughout the years. And today I'm joined by Molly Makishin, back again. Thank you for coming, Molly.
Well, thank you for having me, Kevin.
Molly is a huge cinemaphile and also has a blog, celluloitering.blogspot.com, where she comments about film. And you were last on the show to talk about, I believe it was depiction of drug use, right?
In pop culture? Yes, drug use in film and television. You know, weeds and Pulp Fiction and all that good stuff.
So today we're going to be talking about time travel in pop culture. And, you know, I recently wrote an essay about this topic for The Hi-Hat that should be published hopefully in the near future. And The Hi-Hat is an online magazine at thehihat.com that covers all sorts of topics involving pop culture. It got me thinking about just why time travel works so well as a narrative staple. And it's really not limited to any particular genre, you know, from comedy, from horror to drama. And it's manna from heaven for scriptwriters because it allows them to do so many things with characters, even characters that have been very well established. And so we'll be talking about that on the show today. Just getting back to the beginnings of time travel, you know, we've got H.G. Wells and The Time Machine. H.G. Wells writing The Time Machine back in 1895, and we have seen a couple of cinematic adaptions of that.
I've seen both versions. In the future, basically, H.G. Wells builds this machine that brings him into the future Earth, in which half of society is made up of these Morlocks that are like monsters that live on the Earth, and they feast on these young childlike creatures called the Eloi that are very simple and innocent, and basically, you know, H.G. Wells befriends them and tries to fight the monsters that are eating them. H.G. Wells put a lot of thought into how it would work scientifically, I think, so much so that his time machine only travels through time. It doesn't travel through space. So the idea is that if you go into the future, your time machine stays in the same spot. And if someone moves your time machine, you know, while you're traveling in it, you'll show up wherever they move that to in physical space. You only move forward or backward in time.
So suppose you time travel and someone's built a big stone statue where you're supposed to end up. Is that immediate death for you then, basically?
I would imagine so.
That was the whole big issue with teleportation, you know, the big fear of teleporting into a solid object and your journey ends.
Or you get crossbred with a fly.
Yes, yes.
That's another possibility.
The Jeff Goldblum movie of the 80s.
And don't forget the Vincent Price original fly.
Sure. I mentioned before that one of the qualities of a time travel concept as a narrative staple is that it can be used for so many different genres. So, like I said, you know, from comedy to drama, we have all sorts of films revolving around saving the world, using time travel. So starting with comedy, one of the landmark comedy films to use the time travel storyline would be Back to the Future.
Oh, sure.
And it came out back in 1985 with Michael J. Fox and also Christopher Lloyd. And Christopher Lloyd's this kind of crazy scientist who builds a time machine that's basically a souped-up DeLorean. And Michael J. Fox, as Marty McFly, accidentally goes back into time 30 years in the past, winds up botching the first meeting between his parents and meeting up with the scientist, with Christopher Lloyd back then, and kind of has to figure out a way to get his parents back together so that his existence will be ensured. Like a lot of time travel films, it's also partly a period piece. And that's another reason why time travel films work very well, is because, you know, if you're talking about 1955, it doesn't really matter whether the movie's 20 years old or whether you make the movie today. 1955 is going to be the same.
Right.
You're going to depict it the same way.
I think that's why the first one is so much better than the second one. I don't know if anyone out there has seen the second Back to the Future, but it starts with where the first film ends. Marty McFly goes into the future with his flying DeLorean car, you know, because it's actually in the future all the cars fly. They've been promising us flying cars for years now, and I still haven't gotten one. The problem with future movies is that they always date themselves, because if you watch it in 20 years, say they set something in the year 2005, you know, there were no flying cars in 2005. And I think when you do a period piece, it's, as you said, it's always going to be the same. 50s America is always going to be 50s America. But 2010 is going to be different depending on how far away you are from 2010. So it kind of dates itself. I mean, there were a lot of other problems with the film, too, where writers dropped out, cast members dropped out. Crispin Glover sued the filmmakers because they used footage of him without asking. There was a lot of problems with the film, but I think that the whole idea of it was problematic, of him going into the future.
So Back to the Future, Spielberg was one of the names associated with Back to the Future. He was originally involved in a project called Peggy Sue Got Married.
Ah, yes.
And that project ran into a number of delays, so he's like, ah, forget this, I'm going to work on my own time travel film. And Robert Zemeckis directed, but he was involved with the production. Peggy Sue Got Married is a film also coming out around 86 or so, with Kathleen Turner and also Nicolas Cage, where Kathleen Turner plays this recently separated 40-ish?
She was 32 when the film was made. And what is it? It's her 20th year reunion?
I think it's 20-year high school reunion, so 38. She's very reluctant to go. She doesn't want to see everyone from her past. She's in a very unhappy marriage. She does go. She gets conked on the head. And boom, she's back in the 1960s as a high school senior.
I think it's important to note that I think it would be an entirely different movie if Spielberg had directed it, because it was actually ended up being directed by Francis Ford Coppola of Godfather fame. And I actually think it's a pretty sad movie when you look at it, in the same way that It's a Wonderful Life is kind of sad. She never gets out of her life. She lives to regret the choices that she made, but she ends up making the same exact choices. She goes back and she still picks the same guy, the guy who eventually cheats on her. That's why she leaves him in the first place. Nicolas Cage ends up sleeping with his assistant or something. And so she throws him out of the house. And, you know, then she goes to this reunion, gets conked on the head, and goes back and makes the same choices all over again. And I actually think it's kind of a tragic comedy. It's got kind of a dramatic heft that I don't think it would have had if Steven Spielberg had been at the helm.
Interesting. You're talking about also the choices. And that's one of the appeals behind time travel films. It's that, wow, you've got the ability to go back into the past and fix mistakes and do things differently and explore different possibilities. You're listening to Under Surveillance here on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Molly Mackeshin, and we're talking about the concept of time travel in popular culture. In terms of choices, there's another film that came out in the 90s called Groundhog Day with Bill Murray.
Bill Murray's stuck in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania with Andy McDowell, and he has to relive the same day over and over again. He's stuck in a time loop. They never explain in the film why, but presumably he has to do something differently in his day to get out of it. So he basically just tries experiments with different things that he can do throughout his day, ends up really meeting everybody in the town. He does it hundreds of days. He meets everybody. He does everything. He ends up taking piano lessons. You know, he ends up saving people from accidents and becoming a town hero. And then eventually he wins the heart of his coworker, and he gets to wake up the next day. I love it. I think it's great. It's very funny. I think one of the strongest parts about it is that it doesn't go into the science of how it works. It just is. It's kind of whimsical and magical, and it works, I think, because of that.
it's also, I think, a difference between genres, you know, in terms of Peggy Sue got married. You don't really know why she wakes up in 1960s America as a high school senior again. She just does. You know, you're fine with believing that and then moving on. Whereas in more serious films, with some exceptions, time travel is portrayed in a little bit more of a technical process. For instance, a film like 12 Monkeys,
right,
you know, which is a Terry Gilliam film, came out in the mid-90s with Bruce Willis, where Bruce Willis plays this convict who has to go back 10 years earlier, I believe, and figure out why this mysterious plague happened and how it could be possibly prevented, this plague that wiped out most of humanity. And there you see gadgets and machines, and it looks very, very complicated. You know, you've got scientists everywhere. He's sent back in time originally, and it's not calibrated very well, so he goes back to World War I by accident, you know, and picks up a bullet there. In contrast, you have a film like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure with Keanu Reeves and George Carlin, the late George Carlin, where Keanu Reeves and I believe it's Alex Winter?
Yes.
Okay.
From the Lost Boys.
But these two stoner high school seniors who travel all through time in a phone booth, I believe.
Yeah.
Picking up historical figures because they've got to bring them to their high school for the big senior project.
And isn't that such a kid's fantasy? I mean, I think that's something to time travel movies, and especially when they involve young people, is it such a fantasy? I'm sure lots of kids have thought, man, if only I could travel back in time and do my assignment better. You know, it's very narrow thinking. It's like, oh, I'm going to go get Socrates, and then I'm going to bring him to my presentation. Or he also picks up, what is it, Abraham Lincoln?
Abe Lincoln, Genghis Khan, Joan of Arc.
Joan of Arc. And my favorite part about that movie is not showing them going and picking the guys up, but showing them in the mall when they come back to 1980s America. Because I don't think there's anything really funnier than Joan of Arc running an aerobics class. That was hilarious. What's his name? Beethoven playing the synthesizers.
Yes.
In the music store. Very cute. There are a couple exceptions. You said that most of those time travel movies that are serious are very focused on technology. And there are a couple exceptions I could think of, like The Butterfly Effect with Ashton Kutcher and Amy Smart, where he manages to travel back in time just by focusing on his diary entries. Yeah. This character, Ashton Kutcher, has had blackouts his whole life, and he's able to go back to the times of his blackouts. We are not really sure how, and fix things that have gone wrong in his life. But by making small changes, they end up leading to larger changes in the present. So he keeps screwing things up worse and worse and worse every time he goes back. And there's no real explanation of how that's possible. Another one I can think of is, if you want to treat it like a time travel movie, is Run Lola Run. Lola is played by Franka Potente. She keeps waking up and doing the same day over and over again, three times, and each time she makes different choices. And her first few choices lead to her getting shot or her boyfriend getting shot or something horrible happening. And then every time that segment of the film ends, she wakes up and does the whole thing over again, this time making different choices, having learned from her mistakes. And they never really explain how that's possible either.
It's funny, in Back to the Future, when Michael J. Fox goes back in time, and not only does he get his parents back together, but he also teaches his dad to stand up for himself and to take a more proactive role in his life and to shoot for goals that he had previously dismissed in terms of being an author, for instance. So when he comes back into the future, he's still got his same parents, obviously. He's still got a sister living in the same house, but now his dad's an accomplished author. His mom is
thinner.
She's thinner, yes, exactly. She's in shape. And Biff, who was previously the bully, he comes back and he's
waxing the car.
Waxing the car, yeah. Yes, exactly.
I always wondered, though, why is Marty McFly the same person? Because if you think about it, and I don't want to get too much into the details of time travel, but how can he be the same person if he changes his father's character? That would mean he had a different father who raised him differently. So how would he have the same personality when he went back to the future?
I think it's the same thing with the Butterfly Effect, because Ashton Kutcher goes back in time, changes things, and then comes back to the present, but he still has all the memories for what used to happen.
Right, and that's part I don't really understand about, and I shouldn't pick too much, but I don't really get how that's possible unless you say that the person exists somehow out of time.
here we're talking about the great paradox of traveling into the past. My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and I'm joined by Molly Makishin, and we're talking about time travel and popular culture. You know, that's the kind of the big thing that always comes to mind when you're talking about time travel films that involve going into the past. All sorts of paradoxes, you know, what happens if you kill your parents? Does that destroy yourself as well? That was the big theme with the Terminator. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger as a cyborg who's sent back in time because in the future there's a huge nuclear war where the computers have taken over the Earth, and there's a resistance leader named John Connor who is going to lead humanity back from the brink and destroy Skynet, who's the evil artificial intelligence machine. But then Skynet says, hey, if we send Schwarzenegger back, he'll kill the mother of John Connor, then everything will be gravy for us. And then you kind of think about that and like, well, if they had to send him back in the beginning, doesn't that mean that all the events that led up to that would happen over and over again and you get involved in all sorts of time paradoxes? I think the audience up to a certain point will kind of buy it. Like, okay, whatever, we'll go along with it. And then if you do it too much, then we say, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then I think at that point, you've kind of lost the audience.
Good and consistent. I mean, I think that's what the Terminator is, at least consistent within its own idea of having all these various timelines. The part that gets me, though, is that in the first Terminator, of course, Schwarzenegger goes back and his mangled CPU is found in Terminator 2, which is used to make Skynet's technology in the first place. So really, Skynet in the future creates Skynet in the past. I don't really get how that works, but I guess, you know, part of it, it's for entertainment value. So you really just give yourself a headache if you think about it too much.
Well, it's the same thing with Kyle Reese. Kyle Reese is the soldier sent by humanity back to help Sarah Connor fight the Terminator. He winds up impregnating Sarah Connor along the way.
With
John Connor, yes, exactly.
Well, you could argue that John Connor would have existed with a different father. But it wouldn't be the same person, you know.
Yes.
Exactly. So I see your point. You know, it's really, it doesn't make any sense. But I guess it doesn't really have to make too much sense. Unlike Time Cop.
Jean-Claude Van Damme?
I never did see
that film.
Time Cop's actually based on a comic book. And the comic makes slightly more sense. But the film's just a mess. And the idea is that there are these policemen. Their job are to police timelines. So that if people, evil criminals, start messing around with time travel in various timelines, the cops will go and keep them from changing the future. And it doesn't make any sense at all. It's just a mess. They just jump around and make all these changes in all these different parallel universes and timelines without any explanation for how anything works. The idea that you could police time is kind of ridiculous. To consistently enforce reality. I mean, it's like they know what's supposed to happen and they make sure it happens, but they never really explain how it's even possible.
Well, getting into this subject of policing time, Doctor Who.
Oh, Doctor Who.
Yes. And just to get this out in the open, I'm not a fan of Doctor Who. I've never been a fan of Doctor Who. I understand that there are millions of huge fanatics around the world.
You're going to get a lot of hate mail.
I'm going to get a lot of heat. Yeah, a lot of heat for this. I think it's the longest running sci-fi show in television history. It started, I want to say, was 70s?
68, I think.
I
want to just say right now, I'm not a huge Doctor Who buff, so if I make a mistake, please forgive me. The basic idea is that Doctor Who is a Time Lord. There's a species of aliens called Time Lords. They live on the planet Gallifrey. And Doctor Who's kind of this renegade, and we're not really sure, or at least I'm not really sure, why he's chosen to leave his people. He's in sort of exile from his planet. And he travels around in this machine called the TARDIS, which can move through space and time. The only problem is it was supposed to be able to cloak to look like whatever is the local foliage or set of the time, but it got stuck, so it always looks like a 1950s British police box. It's like blue. So they can end up on a foreign planet and it's a police box sitting in the middle of the set. They originally did that because they ran out of budget. Doctor Who was supposed to be an educational program in the 60s when it was first made. It turned into this big sci-fi phenomenon. But yeah, Doctor Who, he travels through space and time with the idea of righting wrongs.
So he's in a sense another time cop.
He's kind of a time cop. Don't catch me up here. This is Doctor Who is so much cooler than Time Cop. I can't even say. But he goes to different planets, you know, thousands or millions of years apart. He likes Earth. He has an affinity for Earth. He likes people. He likes human beings. So he usually picks up a human to go along with him on his travels. often a pretty young woman, but I should say that's not a strict rule. There have been times when he took non-humans or male characters. One of his sidekicks, Romana, was actually a female Time Lord also, so she was one of his own species. The first Doctor traveled with his own granddaughter, so she was another Time Lord. So it really just depends on which Doctor you have. Also, the Doctor can regenerate, which is perfect for the writers who need to cast a new actor, which is why the show's lasted as long as it has. He can regenerate up to 12 times, and there have been 10 Doctors, so I'm wondering if we're going to run out of Doctor Who in the next two seasons.
It didn't stop the James Bond filmmakers, you know? I mean.
That's true. They just keep on casting somebody. They'll come up with a loophole. They always do. That's why they came up with the regenerations in the first place, because the first Doctor died.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and I'm joined today by Molly Makishin, and we're talking all about time travel and time travel in pop culture. Talked a little bit about Doctor Who. Doctor Who, notorious for what I would consider to be low production values, at least.
Okay, No. Okay, look at Doctor Who, and then look at something comparable of the time, such as Star Trek. Or the original Battlestar Galactica.
The original Battlestar Galactica still had had a huge chunk of money poured into it.
Yeah, but look at it. You know, look at it compared to Doctor Who. I don't really see that much of a difference in production value. I'm sorry.
Okay. I would disagree with that.
or something
not,
like...
Not that the original Battlestar Galactica was a great show, because it wasn't, obviously. It was like about $1 million an episode or something crazy, something astronomical.
Wow.
One of the most expensive shows in history, and that's one of the reasons that they got canceled prematurely. The new Doctor Who does have superior production values, also in terms of just what you can do with computer graphics and you know, digital graphics. You know, you don't have to spend nearly as much money to get a much better result on screen.
Right. I like the new Doctor Who, but I almost think it looks too good. You know, there's something nice about the classic Doctor Who with, like, the cheesy foam set pieces and the wacky makeup. I kind of like that. I don't know, maybe it's just because of nostalgia, but I think it looks a little strange if it looks too realistic, because it's supposed to be fantasy. You know, it's supposed to be fun.
You watch a lot of Mystery Science Theater, Molly?
I do. Yeah. I love it. Manos, The Hands of Fate.
But you don't like watching it with the commentary. You just like watching the straight films.
You know, there's something to be said for cheesy B movies. Oh, they're remaking The Day the Earth Stood Still. This is not relevant to the show, but they are. I saw the preview. Yeah. It's going to be horrible. I'm very sad. But anyway, going back to time travel. Oh, another TV show we got to talk about is Quantum Leap.
Yes, I'm not that familiar with Quantum Leap, actually. I missed it when it originally came around.
Quantum Leap was a show. It premiered, I believe, in 89. I used to love it. Scott Bakula is Dr. Sam Beckett. He gets stuck in some machine he's building. He's a quantum physicist. He's built trying to play around with the time machine. He gets stuck in it, and he ends up switching places with other characters in time throughout his lifespan. So basically, it's not like he travels back in time exactly. It's like he leaps into their bodies and switches places with them. And it can only be from the time he was born to the present day. So it's like a 35-year span of time. That's one of the interesting things about it. I mean, I think they were trying to stay kind of within the realm of plausibility, as it were. I know, you can roll your eyes, because it's not plausible at all. But there is this idea in physics of the bucket theory, where you can't take up any more space or mass than already exists at a given time. Like, you can't go back in time because you can't add your mass to that time, or it would, you know, I don't know what it would do. It would cause the universe to implode or something. So Dr. Sam Beckett goes back in time and switches places with all sorts of wacky characters. And he's a woman, and, you know, he plays a child, or sometimes he's a famous person. Like, I think he was hanging out with Jack Kerouac in one episode. He was Dr. Ruth in another episode. And he's there with his friend, played by Dean Stockwell, who's a hologram. He's not actually physically there. He's just projected from the present day.
So he's also created an artificial intelligence.
No, he's not an artificial intelligence. He's a human being, but he's a projected hologram from the present day. So basically, Scott Bakula is, you know, traveling around righting wrongs, and he's accompanied by this womanizing hologram. Not just a hologram, but a womanizing hologram. And they learn important lessons every week.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And I'm joined today by Molly Makishin, and we're talking about time travel and popular culture. Talked for the last few minutes about Doctor Who and also Quantum Leap. We also want to talk a little bit about romance in terms of time travel. So you have a couple films that you want to...
I do. I just want to preface it by saying I think love story is such a perfect opportunity for time travel as a plot device, because how often have you thought to yourself, oh, you know, if only I had been in the right place at the right time, this relationship would have worked out. And there are a couple movies that play on that. The first one I can think of is The Lake House, which is a 2006 movie made here in Chicago, starring Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves. It's a remake of, I think, a Korean film. But it's about this house with a mailbox that can actually travel between times, 2006 and 2004, I believe. So they're 2 years apart. And Sandra Bullock's in the future. She's a doctor, and she starts communicating with this architect from 2 years before, played by Keanu Reeves. And they fall in love and basically have to figure out a way to fix it so that they can still meet in the present day, you know? So she's telling him, oh, I'm going to be here, you know, please wait for me. And he has to figure out a way to meet up with her. And they're communicating by writing messages in books and leaving the books in certain places and finding them in the future. And it's kind of complicated, but it's a sweet story. And the idea is, you know, they meet 2 years apart, but because they're able to communicate across a time barrier, she's able to wait for him and they end up together. Another example is Somewhere in Time.
It's with Christopher Reeve.
Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour, where he plays a professor that ends up falling in love with her picture in a hotel room. And he finds that if he concentrates on her picture hard enough, he can go back in time to 1919, I think. And that he has to clear everything out of the hotel room that's modern. So he ends up in that hotel room, but, you know, 60 years ago. So he ends up meeting up with her and falling in love and staying with her, and it's a little bit strange. The same falling in love with a picture was used in Happy Accidents, which stars Vincent D'Onofrio and Marissa Tomei. It's an interesting film made by Brad Anderson, who also did The Machinist, where basically Marissa Tomei falls in love with this guy who seems really sweet, played by Vincent D'Onofrio, but he keeps claiming he's from the year 2470. And that he found her picture in an antique shop in the future, fell in love with her, and came back in time to be with her. And she thinks he has epilepsy and is just crazy. And so the film is kind of about, all right, is this person crazy? Is he really from the future? If he is from the future, how am I going to handle it? And, you know, and I'm sorry.
Just the fact that all these people are falling in love with pictures, does it kind of bother you a little bit, you know?
It's a little ridiculous. I think it's just a way to set it up, because that's one of the ultimate things that stand in the way of a relationship, is you're from different time periods. Look at
it's
this.
Something of a barrier, yes.
Yeah, look at the movie, and this is not a good movie, so I'm not recommending it, but Kate and Leopold.
Okay.
Which stars Meg Ryan and Hugh Jackman, who, you know, she's a modern woman, but she wants a real chivalrous man, you know, an old-fashioned romantic guy. And she ends up getting Hugh Jackman, who's like a late 19th century nobleman, and he treats her like a lady, you know. And so she gets to have it all. She's a modern woman with a real gentleman of a boyfriend. And, of course, it's a fish-out-of-water story, because he has to get used to modern days. But it's very cheesy, romantic look, you know, at what women supposedly want. The only problem is I don't think she realizes how they treated women in the 1890s. It wasn't exactly an enlightened time. You know, she wouldn't be allowed to work, for instance, if she were married to a nobleman. And it completely ignores that fact. So that movie really bothers me. But it's another example of time travel used in a romantic comedy.
It's not so much a romantic comedy, but the Time After Time is a very interesting film with, I believe it's Malcolm McDowell.
Mm-hmm. And David Werner.
Yes.
As Jack the Ripper.
As Jack the Ripper. Malcolm McDowell playing H.G. Wells, who has actually built a time machine. In the beginning of the film, the police are on the trail of Jack the Ripper, and they track him to H.G. Wells' home. And it turns out that Jack the Ripper has taken the time machine and gone into the future, into, I believe it's 1979 San Francisco. The machine automatically returns back to the 1800s. H.G. Wells goes and follows him, and he's expecting utopia. And what he finds is obviously very different, and society has become much more violent, at least compared to what he was expecting. And Jack the Ripper, he meets up with H.G. Wells and says, hey, you know, back in London, I was a mass murderer. Here, I'm just, you know, criminal.
I'm an amateur.
Yeah, I'm an amateur. Exactly.
Yeah. I think it's a wonderful social critique of modern day, or at least back then it was modern day, where Jack the Ripper can run around and kill people and it's not really a big deal. Although, you know, his killings do make the paper in modern day San Francisco. but he's not the notorious monster of old that he was at the time.
Along the way, H.G. Wells meets up with a woman who...
Mary Steenburgen,
mm-hmm. who, and they have this romance that blossoms during the film, and she becomes a target for Jack the Ripper, and eventually she returns with him.
She goes back with him, and actually, I forget her name. I think it's... I can't remember it. That is actually the name of H.G. Wells' second wife, is the character's name and of the person he falls in love with. So the idea is that his second wife in real life he got from the future, which is cute. You know, it's a cute idea.
You're talking about fish out of water. I mean, because that's just a narrative staple for time travel films. There was Star Trek IV that came out back in 1984, also featuring San Francisco, where the crew of the Enterprise have to go back into time.
And get a humpback whale.
And get a humpback whale and load it on their ship and bring it back to the future because there's some kind of crazy alien destroying the universe and only the sounds that the humpback whale can emit will help them stave off extinction. And so, of course, you've got Scotty and Sulu and everyone back in 1984 San Francisco, and they're trying to communicate with the computers by talking to the mouse. You've got Spock giving the Vulcan nerve grip to some punk guy on the bus who flips the bird to James T. Kirk.
And, you know, I think that's what Star Trek writers do when they get bored. They find a way to go back in time. That's what the holodeck really can do. I mean,
I was thinking about that.
Yeah, on Star Trek, the Next Generation TV show, the holodeck is such a huge part of their life there because it's a good way to avoid getting stir crazy. You go on the holodeck and you can go back in time, or at least simulate going back in time. And I'm sure, like, whenever they wanted to do a period piece, they could easily explain it, where they would be simulating, you know, going into Richard III or old-timey West pioneer days, or whenever they go gangster. There was a Chicago gangster episode with Data, like, dressed in a three-piece suit, toting a gun. Yeah, but Star Trek IV really is kind of the pinnacle of that. Well, there's also that episode of the classic Star Trek, The City at the Edge of Forever, where James T. Kirk goes back in time to 1930s Depression era America, falls in love with a woman played by Joan Collins, saves her from dying, and then finds out that because he saved her, she starts a peace movement that prevents America from stopping the Nazis, and the Nazis get the bomb and destroy the world. So he has to go back again and make sure she dies so that he can save the world, so that there can be a Starfleet. And so that's another example of time travel being used in Star Trek.
We talked a little bit about the butterfly effect in terms of going back in time and fixing past wrongs. Right. Donnie Darko also addresses that as well, too. Donnie Darko is a film that came out, I want to say, about 5-6 years ago, and starring Jake Gyllenhaal and also his sister Maggie. They are brother and sister in Home, and in the beginning of the film, out of nowhere, you have this huge aircraft engine that crashes down from the sky and rips a hole through Donnie Darko, who's Jake Gyllenhaal, through Home. And all sorts of weird, crazy things start happening. Donnie Darko reads about time travel. There's a crazy neighbor who wrote a book about time travel a long time ago. Eventually, the movie turns into that kind of dilemma of how do I correct past wrongs.
I thought it was interesting because a lot of the time you're not sure if Donnie Darko is really traveling through time or if he is just mad because he has this mental illness, right? Supposedly schizophrenia, and he's seeing visions of this giant rabbit.
Yes.
This giant, horrible-looking rabbit, which I can only assume is an homage to Harvey, you know, starring Jimmy Stewart with his big invisible rabbit companion. So he sees this giant rabbit, and it turns out, you know, we're not sure, is this a hallucination or is this a vision from the future? And we end up thinking it's a vision from the future because somebody has that costume, has the rabbit costume. But you're not entirely sure whether or not he's got psychic powers or if he's really traveling through time or if he's just crazy. And I thought that ambiguity was interesting.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And I'm joined by Molly Mankishin, and we've been talking about time travel and popular culture, all sorts of time travel films throughout the years, and whether they've been comedies, horror, drama, everything in between. Another film, more of a comedy, doesn't really fall into any strict genre, I suppose, but Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits. And we talked a little bit about 12 Monkeys earlier in the show. Time Bandits was Terry Gilliam's first film.
I want to start out by defending Time Bandits because I know how you feel about it, Kevin. And it was his first film of a trilogy. And the whole idea, let me just preface it by saying the whole idea of Time Bandits is it's supposed to be the first part of a trilogy with Brazil and the Adventures of Baron Munchausen. And it was his exploration of imagination and how important it is for someone's development as a person to have imagination. So Time Bandits is supposed to be about this little boy that travels with a bunch of dwarves who kind of live outside of time, and they go through different historical periods and have adventures. You know, this is supposed to be childhood imagination, whereas Brazil is the power of imagination in adulthood, and Baron Munchausen's about this old man and his imagination. So going back to Time Bandits, you know, he has this magical map that these dwarves use to travel through all these historical periods. And the film is kind of a mess because it doesn't exactly have a narrative. I mean, it just kind of goes through a bunch of glorious set pieces. You know, the dwarves run around screaming and they have adventures, and Monty Python's half of their troupe is there. And it's a visually stunning film. Doesn't really have much of a plot. But it also doesn't get caught up too much with the technicalities of time travel because, you know, it's kind of taken for granted that these are time bandits. That's what they do.
Oh, yeah. From that standpoint, I think the film is perfectly fine. I mean, you know what you're getting into. Now, I saw the film originally in the theaters. I think I saw it a couple times when I was 7 years old. And the film worked for me back then.
It was back when you had imagination.
Back when I had imagination, and I wasn't the jaded fellow that is talking on the microphone right now. It's just been sucked dry right out of me. When did you see Time Bandits?
I guess I was about 8 or 9.
Okay.
You know,
So you remember it, but you haven't seen it since.
I've seen bits and pieces of my favorite sections, but, you know, you're right. You got me. It's just more like I'm still holding on to that love from being little, you know. But it's still, you know, there's some parts. The parts where, like, the walls suddenly start expanding away, you know, and they tumble through space and they end up on battlefields with horses. And it's just fun. It's a lot of fun.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you are listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and I'm joined here by Molly Makishin. Molly Makishin is a huge cinemaphile. She also has a blog at celluloitering.blogspot.com, where she comments about film. Thanks so much, Molly, for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a good time.
For Molly Makishin, I'm Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. For more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.